The Hope of Glory.
For our opening text, we thought we'd use Colossians 1:27 and also Lamentations 3:21 and 26. To them, God chose to make known how great among the Gentiles are the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And again, in Lamentations 3:21, but this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Now, hope is an absolute essential in the life of every man, woman, and child. Sometimes we think of hope as limited to the Christian life, but it is not. No, hope is spread generously into the lives of men on all levels. It is one of the greatest controlling mechanisms of men, one of the greatest inspiring and moving mechanisms of men, because so much depends on hope. It seems fitting that we examine hope in its proper place in our lives. Now, this is a very large subject, and we're not going to limit it to its strictly scriptural sense. Although that is the burden, the scriptural sense is the burden of our message. But I think it's got to go through a broader spectrum sometimes to appreciate the value of hope in the lives of men. Now, first, let me say that you will not successfully avoid hope in your life. You will find some hope, whether it is worthy or unworthy of your sacrifice. But you will find a hope to which you cling. In all probability, you will find yourself leaning on some staff of hope on which to carry you through in the days of your life. Now let us look at hope. Self-sacrifice, the giving of oneself unstintingly, sharing and cooperating in action with others, is most difficult unless you have hope. When today is all that there is, why, we grab onto it and we hold on to it. When afloat in an ocean of nothingness, why, what do? Why, you hang on to any miserable piece of wreckage as though it were the tree of life. That is all there is. And so you cling to it. That is the only thing you have. And that is your hope that you cling to, in the hope that if you could survive a bit, it may bring you out of that place to a larger fulfillment of hope on another plane. And on the other hand, when we stand on the threshold of hopes fulfilled, gloriously near at hand, how easy it is to share all that we have and to forego advantages that are even within our grasp, because we are standing on the thresholds of our joys and the fulfillment of our hope. And so we sing, why grasp at transitory toys so near to heaven's eternal joys? Why, these things seem as nothing when we can in our minds envision that we are on the threshold of a fulfillment of our hope. Common suffering, when not joined by hope, does not unite people. Often it embitters them. Nobility, therefore, does need a backbone. It needs the backbone of hope upon which to build. Now notice the Israelites in bondage in Egypt. They were bitter. They were in hard bondage. And they were not well organized. And they were without hope. They didn't have a hope of returning to the promised land. And in this state of mind, they were oppressed, and their burden seemed heavier. Everything seemed more dismal. They were slaves in Egypt, and without hope of deliverance. And therefore, they were a sad and unhappy people. And Moses, who originally tried to give the Israelites some hopes, initially, remember, when he was 40 years old, he went to them to lead them as a great leader might hope to do. But he could not succeed in implanting a hope in their hearts and lives, and they did not accept him as a leader. Later in the providence of God, he succeeded in his second attachment to these people to give them a hope of deliverance. But when the Israelites found that the plagues were going on, and their burdens were getting worse, and the hope didn't seem to ever have any possibility of fulfillment, and they saw their condition as worsening instead of getting better, why, they became bitter. And even Moses became upset, and he went to the Lord inquiring why this evil should befall the people. And even in our time, 30,000 hopeless people in the concentration camp at Buchenwald did not develop any form of united action, nor did they manifest any readiness for self-sacrifice. There was more greed and ruthless selfishness practiced among those inmates in that concentration camp than in any corrupt society. Instead of studying the way in which they could best help each other, they used all the ingenuity that they had to dominate and to oppress each other. But this was natural. Having lost hope, these people behaved normally for people without hope. These people, who in normal life were close-knit in business and in family, became isolated from each other in the concentration camps, and they were alone and without hope. They had no way to work together, and they could not think together because the Gestapo had succeeded in taking away all hope, and they were left the poorest of all people, because when you take away a man's hope, you virtually destroyed him. Now, in the Warsaw Ghetto, the Jews behaved quite differently. Even though the odds were stacked all against them, and their hope was only a slender reed, yet they quit themselves like men. Their bravery was incredible. They struggled together. They worked together. And they self-sacrifice. Men would give their lives freely to save another man. Why? Because at least in that condition, they had a slender reed of hope. They were struggling for a common cause and for the attainment of a fulfillment of a common end. And so they were gladly willing to suffer and to die even for such a slender hope. But that was all they had, was the slender hope. And so, dear friends, you must never be without a hope, a good hope. Those without hope are isolated from others. They become islands to themselves and will be driven to desperate self-seeking. No one is more lonely, and no one is more to be more pitied than the man without hope. Now, and I am giving this talk largely because I see many young people here. And there are many brands of hope that are bidding for the attention of the young. And so the young are faced with the great difficulty of choosing a hope, a goal, the right goal, and the best hope, the one that will not leave them brokenhearted and empty. And to have such a hope requires the precondition that the hope be built upon not only a worthy cause, a selfless one, but that it be a realizable and worthwhile hope. The false hope often makes the journey to the goal more satisfying than the point when you arrive at the goal. You know, the man who is really broken, the man that's most disappointed, who has had a hope all for, and he struggled to attain it for many years, And then he arrives at that destination, at the fulfillment of that hope, which he had dreamed and hoped for so long. And when he gets there, he's disappointed. Why, the journey to the fulfillment of that goal was far more joy than when he realizes it. That's a false hope. He labored for something that really he was deceived upon. He thought that that hope would bring him certain joys. But when he gets it, he's so disappointed. Now the modern man is being taught to strive for realizable goals in his present lifespan. And when you are certain of no other goals, well, that's a reasonable condition. In other words, they are telling you in the schools of our land that keep your hopes in touch with reality, with things that can be seen. Even though we know from the scriptural standpoint that the hopes that are built upon the things that are seen are what? They're transitory. They won't survive very long. They will disappear. They'll wither as you touch them and use them. And they'll die oftentimes within your hand. They're transitory. Nothing bolsters a man's self-confidence and reconciles a man with himself as the continuous ability to create, to see things grow and develop under his abilities. A man will inevitably show you, when he takes you into his confidence, his handiwork. And this is true of the artisan or the financier or the professor or the researcher or the farmer or the gardener. If they have labored with something, when they take you into their confidence, they'll show you the things that they have labored to create. Now the man who is successful in achieving in this life, whether it be on a material level or on a mental level, is basically what we would consider a short-term man of hope in his particular field. As long as this individual is successful in achieving, he tends to be conservative. He is what we call a well-adjusted individual in this world. He's at home with the world. He's an achiever with the world. The world looks to him. He's reconciled to the world, and the world is reconciled to him because he's an achiever, and the world loves achievers. That's what they want. They claim and proclaim the name of all the achievers, and failures, they don't want those. His goals, therefore, are realizable and observable, and he accepts discipline and self-sacrifice necessary to achieve these short-term goals or hopes. Now, Nimrod once had a short-term goal, and he said to his fellow men, "Let us go build a city." Oh, what a powerful suggestion. If you will build a city, why, you will have a part in it. And it will be a glorious city. And so men were moved, and they joined with Nimrod to build that city. Yes, and the world knows that this is an enormous energizer of men, and so they are always appealing to youth. And they give them short-term goals. They say, "Let us go to the moon. Let us go to the bottom of the ocean. Let us solve the cause of cancer. Let us grow two grass blades where one grew before." These are all things that may be proper in themselves. They're achievements. And they are preconditioning the minds of youth to take these short-term goals and to work at them, to sacrifice themselves, to give themselves over to these short-term goals so that they can have a fulfillment of hope on a short-time level. But look at Nimrod. He was a short-term builder. The city he built, as glorious as it may have seemed to him and others, was soon left for someone else to inhabit. Yes. Now there was another man who lived shortly thereafter, whose name was Abraham. He didn't build any cities. You know where he lived? He lived in a tent. And how long did he live there? He lived all his life in a tent. But didn't he think about cities? Of course he thought about cities, but he was never moved to build one. But he dreamed of, and he thought of, and he thought continually about a city whose builder and maker was God. And now, centuries later, we see the name of Abraham as one of the heroes of faith. He's the man that we remember as we look at and study the Holy Writ. But Nimrod, why, we've forgotten about him and his city. And we're still looking for that same city that Abraham was looking for, whose builder and maker was God. He, Abraham, had the proper hope. Even though it was a long-term goal, yet Abraham will have a fulfillment of that hope. And what a grand fulfillment it will be when that glorious city whose builder and maker is God is upon the earth, and Abraham has a part in that city. And where will Nimrod be? He'll still be trying to build another city. We hope he'll learn to accept that great city. Now, building cities and short-term goals does not appeal to everyone alike, because not all men are achievers. Persons with smaller creative powers and less ability to achieve successfully in this competitive world are not so inclined to go out and build cities. But mass movements come upon the scene, and they are the ones that appeal to the underachiever. And they give him an inflated sense of accomplishment, not because of anything that he can achieve, but they tell you that if you will join with us in a larger movement, through this movement there will be an accomplishment, an achievement, and you will share in the achievement of this larger group, and so therefore you will be an achiever. You will have a fulfillment of a short-term hope. And so we see we're living in a time where the colleges and the universities, they're appealing to men on all levels. And you find that youth is amenable to these. They are joining up with these short-term goals. They are in with a peace movement. Oh, they stand up and they're against the war in Vietnam or some other cause. And they identify with a movement. These people who maybe we're unachievers in some respects, suddenly they stand on their feet and they feel stronger and better and taller than other men now, because they identify with a movement, with a cause which they feel is higher than themselves. And they are turned into an element of aggressive people. They are zealous. Now they are committed suddenly. These unachievers on one level are now suddenly committed. They're standing for a cause. They're preaching for something. They're standing for something, even though it's a short-term hope. It gives them a sense of fulfillment. And so they join it. Now, the credit for shaping the destiny of nations often goes to the men of superior quality, the great politicians, the great scientists, the great financiers, the great industrialists. Well, maybe they play a role in history. But often overlooked are those who have lost their footing in society, the disillusioned, the disenchanted, the misfits, the outcasts in society. The game of history is played by the best of men and also the least important of men. The latter class see their lives as meaningless, spoiled, and they are without reverence for the present or the past. These are first in line to endorse the wave of the future with chauvinistic loyalty. Without this element, the nation would shape or lack the seeds of thing to come. You know how America was built? Well, it was mostly the underachievers in Europe, the people who were persecuted, the people that didn't have the good jobs, the people that were on the outer circle of achievement, who had lost their footing in Europe, who were persecuted or for some way or other didn't fit in to the achievement of Europe. It was these to whom going to America appealed. And they came here in large numbers. The successful men of Europe the achievers, why they looked at America, well, that was not a land for them. That was all the riffraff of Europe was coming here, and they were glad to be rid of them. They were the underachievers. Nothing good could come of this nation. But how surprised they must have been to find that these people who had lost their footing in Europe, they came here and they found their footing, and they became achievers in their own right. One of the reasons we beat the British was that some of the shipbuilders who didn't have the best jobs in Britain came over here. They weren't the leading brains in the shipbuilding business there. They were men who were without work. And they found their way to America. And what did they do when they got here? They were so determined to make good. They came here and they built better ships. And though we had fewer ships, the American Navy was able to best the British. And so this country gained its independence. Now, we're not concerned with that as men, naturally, but it illustrates the truth, the necessity for a hope to identify with something. The man who has lost his footing is not necessarily an underachiever in himself, but he is one whom society has so disciplined and has so relegated that he believes himself and realizes himself not to be an achiever, but given another situation and another goal, and he can be made to achieve. Now, action is a unifier. The active person tends toward uniformity. Men of thought, strange as this may seem, seldom work well together with men of action. Those who came to this country filled with ideals and ideologies measured this land against those ideals and ideologies, and they came away from this land disappointed. Why, this didn't measure up to what they expected. But the men with less talent, they came here to make a living. They came here to find themselves. And they weren't critical of this land, and they just merged right in. Necessity was laid upon them. They put their hand to the plow. Whatever they had to do, they worked, and they turned this country into a mighty empire. Now, mass movements avail themselves of actions as a means of unification. The conflicts of a mass movement seeks to serve not only downs the enemy, but also it strips the individual of his individuality. That's what a mass movement is about. You'll recall the Nazi movement in Germany. They were great at stripping the individual of his individuality. The church for centuries was great at doing this. And the Nazis, one of the means that they used to keep men from their individuality was marching. Hermann Rosling, who at first thought this eternal marching in Germany was senseless, it was a waste of time and energy, later, he acknowledged it was a great thing. It had a subtle effect. He said, marching diverts men's thoughts. Marching kills thought. Marching makes an end of individuality. And that's what they needed to build a totalitarian state. And the church likewise kept its believers, as it were, marching. It kept them fingering those beads, saying Hail Mary and praying to their candles and so on. They lost their individuality. They lost their thought. They lost their identity in a movement. Well, that is not God's way. Faith in a cause organizes and equips a man's soul for action. To be in possession of a truth on a subject or a world problem or an ideology or a religious truth, and to combine this with a feeling that God and destiny or the law of history is with that cause, and that all that stands in the way of that supreme cause is unworthy, evil, and ought to be removed or destroyed, is the groundwork for mass action. And under these influences, spiritless and inert men have turned to great builders and enormously energized performers. The difference, however, between a fanatic and the Christian is that the Christian, he's just as determined as the fanatic. He's just as committed as the fanatic. But the difference is he is committed to the truth, to the right. Whereas the fanatic, he's all centered and built up into a wrong concept. But that's the difference. The two are very close. The two are both willing to accept the sacrifice and the discipline necessary to achieve certain goals. And so how important that we have our minds and hearts centered in the truth, lest when it is all said and done, it turns out that we were only fanatics. Now, youth and mass movements came to a point of disregard in the family. You remember how in the German regime they succeeded in alienating the child from his parents. Why, brother was delivering brother up to death in that regime. And we know that that was true also in church history. They were delivering brother up to brother. They were betraying one another. For what? For the higher cause, supposedly. Well, this was not Christianity. And some have tried to show that this was a quality of Christianity, but they made a mistake. They judged the nominal Christianity, the Satan's counterfeit of true Christianity, and they have concluded that that is the path of Christianity, is to turn and alienate a man from his family. And while there are some things in Jesus' words that might imply that, he said, a man's foes shall be those of his household. He said, I am not come to set at variance. I am come to set a man at variance with his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be those of his own household. And then again he said, remember when they were inquiring, some said, your mother and your brother are standing without. Why, he said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And then he said, the one that had the preferred relationship, the one that did the will of his Father in heaven, these were the ones that were his mother and brother. But these are not to lead us to conclude that true Christianity is a betrayal of the family circle. No, nothing could be further from the truth. Christianity makes a Christian a better husband, a better father, a better mother, a better daughter, a better relative in every sense. Never does the Christian betray, but he helps and blesses those within the circle of his fellowship. Now, the reason for this discussion is for one purpose, simply to tell you what you already know, but in a different way. In our time, it is easy to think of worldly institutions, whether they be colleges and universities, perhaps some modern and humanitarian peace movements, or peace corps, or even some church movements, as being far more concerned with human need than are the Lord's people. Perhaps maybe sometimes selfless in the quest of alleviating human suffering, and by contrast certainly more practical than the Christian life standards which you and I are familiar with. Now we freely admit there is much good in these causes, and we are not out to censor society for the good that is in it. However, the path of true Christianity, so misunderstood by the world, is still the best way to do the most good, not only for the world, but for you as an individual. Because true Christianity is such a scarce commodity, the world has never been able to judge the world. As the Apostle says, he that is spiritual examines all things, but he himself is examined by no man. No man in the world can properly evaluate Christianity. What wise man in this world could tell you how to go about to make a new creation? Why, they've never even heard of it. They know nothing of the things that you and I speak about, that eye hath not seen, nor ear has heard, nor has even entered into the heart of man. It would all be madness, surely, to them. But Jesus never built Christianity on the level of a mass movement. He did more to destroy group psychology as a movement builder than any man. The only reason, for instance, that Christianity was to bring division in the family is not because Christians would forsake or betray his family or cease to love them. Quite the reverse. The Christian always becomes a better individual. But the point of division is the point of righteousness on one hand, and the refusal of the Christian to follow blindly in mass political, social, or religious movements. To the Christian, the individual is always important. And that's not true with a movement. You know, movements are interested in the individual intensely, but only for one reason. All movements show a great deal of interest in the individual as long as that individual is helping them get to the place where they want to go. The individual is only a pawn to the movement. If you can help them get to the place where they want to go, you're great. But the moment the individual is no longer contributing to their cause, the moment he becomes critical of that movement, the moment he stands in the way of anything that he may deem is wrong in that movement, suddenly he is a traitor. He is set aside. He is no longer a use to them. He was only a pawn. They were using him to get to the place where they wanted to go. And that's true of all movements. But God and true Christianity are not movements. God has never been interested in the individual to get to the place where he wants to go. His first concern is for you. And his last concern is for you. His interest and his love is for you. Your activities are only the means of your development and the development of those about you. But he is never using his people as pawns. And never should you get in the habit of using others of the Lord's people as pawns to get to the place where you want to go. Because that is not Christianity. That is mass movement psychology. And we must be so careful that we don't imbibe this spirit. Now when the crowds followed Jesus, he would dispatch them very quickly. Sometimes he would be very harsh on them. Remember one time these people, they came all the way around the lake to seek him. And what did he say to them? Oh, bless you for coming to follow me. Did he ingratiate this audience with words that would enchant them? Why, no. He says, you came apparently for the loaves and fishes. And they were a little bit disturbed with that. Well, they said, what's wrong with that? You know, Moses, why, he gave his followers manna in the wilderness. Ah, yes, Jesus was not appealing to the crowds on that level. Yes, he even offended that crowd later by telling them, unless they ate his flesh and drank his blood, why, they would have no purpose with him. And, of course, the crowds left him. He really insulted them. They had come there with great anticipations, and they left, I think, a little bit piqued that day, a little bit angry and disappointed with the treatment that Jesus had given them. Now, we go on. We must have hope. Now, nothing I say is intended to influence, particularly the youth, in terms of their short-term goals. We all have to have jobs. We all have to have occupations. We must have short-term goals. And there's nothing wrong with these. We have to make our living. We have to be in this world, even though we are not a part of it. And it's proper that we have short-term goals. But we must remember, in these short-term goals, that the greater success we have in these, the greater your achievement in fulfilling short-term material hopes, the less, and this is the enigma, the less likely you will be to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, "How hardly shall a rich man enter the kingdom of heaven?" Yes, it's impossible. They have to unload. No rich man can enter the kingdom of heaven unless really he uses his riches ultimately for God's glory. That's the lesson. And if we are so busy achieving in this world and accomplishing, and we become imbued with our short-term achievements, how easy it is for this to wean us away, for this long-term commitment that we have, our true hope, the one really for which we live and for which we hope to die by God's grace. So how careful we should be. And that's why the scriptures say, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall see God." Oh, you know, the poor in spirit, they are not the great achievers. They're mourning. They're poor in spirit. But that will be turned into a great asset because they have a better chance of achieving on the higher goal if they use that opportunity. We must hurry on here. I didn't realize the time was passing so quickly. God chose the foolish things in this world, that is, the underachievers, to bring to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in His presence. Can't you see that the Lord has taken largely the underachievers of this world, and with this class He will bring to naught the great achievers of the world? And we are living in that time where shortly we will see the great men of the world, the mighty men, weeping bitterness with darkness, bitterly with darkness upon all faces, as they see all that they have achieved coming to ruin. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Friends, hope must be a part of your life. The grandest of all hopes, not only for the church of God, but also the world, lies in Christ. And you are the blessed ones to whom God would make known what is the riches of this mystery among the Gentiles. It's a mystery among the Gentiles, and that mystery is Christ in you, the hope of glory, the greatest hope, the kind of a hope that eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, nor has even entered into their mind, but God by His Spirit hath revealed this unto you. The hope of glory is unlike the hope of so many movements that speak of hope, but the grand designs they speak of are never for those who labor for them. You know, the hope of mass movements, they have hopes, but the man who plants, he's one man, and the other man eats. One man builds and another man dwells in what the other man built. But it is written, for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher in hope, thresh in hope of a share in the crop. And those who are called to glory and honor, immortality, must share in the harvest by the principle of God's dealings. The hope of glory does not end with glory for the church, but it continues. The glory grows, and it embraces the whole world with a real and living hope, the hope that will last forever. No short-term cities like Nimrod built, but an identification with a city whose builder and maker is God. And therefore, hope. What is this hope, and what can it do for you? Why, hope enables us to be patient. Hope enables us to endure suffering and shame. Remember Jesus, for the joy that was set before Him, He endured the cross and disregarded the shame. That joy was a hope, was it not? Hope enables us to be generous. Hope contributes toward a willingness to sacrifice and labor. If you find that you are unwilling to sacrifice and labor, look at your hope, and you'll find that you're down on your hope. And if that hope is revived, you'll find that it will energize you to sacrifice and labor. Hope unites those with similar hope in a common cause. This is the kind of unity that the Lord's people need, not the unity that we had in movements. Very often we lose that unity, and then we cry, where is that unity? Well, it was only the unity that a movement brought us. But the unity of hope and faith in the hope of glory, if we share that alike, it is a great unifying thing, and nothing can break that unity. Hope gives meaning and purpose. Life will never degenerate into an endless succession of meaningless days and nights. It will never be a never-ending toil and uncomforted mourning. No, not as long as there is hope. It is only when we lose hope that we become despondent. It is only when we lose hope that we are no longer joyous. It is only as we lose hope that we cannot be generous. It is only as we lose hope that we cannot sacrifice. It is only as we lose hope that we fail in our Christian devotion. But if we can get that hope, why, if we can hold on to it every day and hour, why, we'd be walking on a cloud into the kingdom. Would it not be so? If we could but grasp the joys of that hope that is before us. And so, in conclusion, in Romans, the 8th chapter, verses 24 and 25, for in this hope we are saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait with patience for it. And again in Romans 5, in our concluding text, verses 2 to 5. Through him we have obtained access into this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice. How do we rejoice? We rejoice in our hope of sharing the glory of God. More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. Real hope takes Christian character. That's the point. You can't have this hope without a development of the corresponding character of Christ. But character produces hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. Amen.